Welcome to installment 197 of Sefer Mitzvahs from the Rambam. Today we will continue our discussion of positive commandment 107, the commandment regulating tumah, or the impurity conveyed by a dead body. To briefly review, the Rambam in Sefer Mitzvahs mentions that this commandment includes all of the laws governing the impurity conveyed by a dead body, that in distinction with other forms of impurity, which could be conveyed when someone touches the source of impurity, and in other cases even when one carries it, even without touching it, the impurity of a dead body is unique in that it is conveyed even through tumas oihel, even through a tent, meaning that the source of impurity and the person or object being subject to the impurity share a common roof. Both are under the same roof, which, as we explained, has important implications as far as entering hospitals which have a morgue or a pathology lab, and so on, as these laws of purity and impurity, although they apply primarily in the times of the Beis HaMikdash of the Temple, nevertheless apply to Kohanim today as well. We also briefly discussed in yesterday's portion the very relevant question in which the Rambam discusses in these laws as to when a person is considered dead. Since obviously this impurity is not conveyed unless the person is dead, one must make an exact determination of the moment of death. And it is clear from the Torah's point of view that it is the cessation of heartbeat and respiration which normally coincide, which is the Torah's definition. And in fact, this was also the secular definition for many, many years, until in recent times has been an effort to legislate the so-called brain death, which, as we discussed, is in reality not any type of death, even according to the medical community, but rather is an irreversible coma, that the person would never return or is unlikely to return from the comatose state. To briefly continue and conclude this discussion today, it would be sufficient for us to know that this is the Torah's definition of death, and therefore it is binding upon us, and apparently this applies for Jew and non-Jew alike. However, we have in addition several explanations which could help us understand this idea and perhaps help us explain it to others. First of all, again, from the Torah's point of view, we mentioned that a term commonly used for death is yetzias neshama, when the soul leaves the body. Now, since we cannot actually define a soul when it is present and when it is absent, except with the help of the Torah, because otherwise we cannot really detect its presence or absence, we must look at the Torah to tell us when it is that the soul leaves the body. As the head of the Harvard Ad Hoc Committee, which was appointed the task of, quote-unquote, redefining death, as he said, since we cannot define life, how can we define death? We find only in the Torah a definition of when life is present, and thereby can extrapolate to know when life has ceased. It is apparent from this point of view that any discussion of, quote-unquote, quality of life is irrelevant, as has surreptitiously crept in to many discussions regarding euthanasia and related topics, that we look at the quality of life. What sort of life? How useful a life is the person leading? Such a concept should certainly be suspect to anyone, any thinking person, and certainly to a Jewish person. As the prestigious English medical journal Lancet once asked, that if euthanasia is granted to the first class, can it long be denied to the second? Each step is so short, the slope so slippery, and our values in this age so uncertain and unstable, recognizing that there is a great potential for abuse of this concept. If a person that was on the stage just about to die could have his life shortened, then who is to say that other unfortunate, either mentally or physically disabled or deformed people, or senile or aged, or otherwise, people that could be looked on as having a poor, quote-unquote, quality of life, people that a particular society looks upon as no longer being useful, that their lives could also be shortened? The Jewish people in particular, who have, as we have been subject in recent history, God forbid, that we were looked upon as being useless and harmful to society and not even worthy of human life, like flies and animals to be destroyed. Certainly, that's among the most advanced civilizations of the modern world could look upon human life in such a fashion should lead us to look very, very suspiciously on any such discussion of quality of life, since in reality it is very easy that such a concept could lead to destruction of human life. This worry and concern, which might be suspect in an abstract sense, can actually be realized if one closely examines the writings of prominent figures in various professional journals. Fletcher, who was known as a prominent in the field of ethics, has declared that just as we can redefine what life is when it comes to the end of a person's lifespan, so too we should be able to redefine it at the beginning of a person's lifespan. Therefore, just as society has redefined death, we can redefine life. And therefore, this point of view says that we see that abortion hasn't been legalized in civil law in many places, although certainly according to Torah law it remains forbidden, except in certain cases where the mother's life should be in danger. The argument continues further, says Fletcher, that so too we should be able to end a life right after birth as well. Why should we differentiate between immediately before birth? When society allows an abortion, we should see if the child should be desirable. Perhaps, God forbid, it will be deformed in some way. We should allow an abortion, quote-unquote, in such a time period. The prominent Crick, who was involved in the discovery of DNA and won a Nobel Prize, advocated legislation, in fact, that newborn babies would not be considered live until 2 days after birth. And his colleague Watson went even further to say 3 days. Therefore, one would have a choice until 3 days after a child's birth, according to this idea, to decide whether the child would be declared alive or not. And this was printed in the journal, one journal of the American Medical Association. Furthermore, a professor of philosophy at a top university in the country argued furthermore that he sees nothing wrong with declaring a child dead officially within 2 weeks after the child is born. Therefore, one would have a choice of not ever having a birth certificate issued until 2 weeks after the child is born. And should the parent for some reason be unhappy for the way the child is born, then an abortion could be performed, technically, even though the child is born already. Who is to say where the limit could be drawn? From all of these frightening statements, we can see that any discussion about when life begins or ends, or when death occurs, even without going to the source of Jewish faith, the Torah, simply by common moral and rational grounds, it is impossible to investigate the quality of life. Because where does one stop if one starts to weigh and estimate the value of a life? Clearly there is no place where one can stop. And should a person desire to have some explanation to see what is the worth of a life, even though we see no apparent benefit from it, for example, in the case where a person is in a coma, the Torah contains several answers to this question. One, we see in the laws regarding burial of a person that a person that commits suicide, God forbid, has committed a very extreme crime against Hashem, that a person that commits suicide is forbidden to, one, he may not be buried together with others in the same part of the cemetery. He must be buried in a separate part of the cemetery. There are, however, several limitations on this law. One of them being that if the person has died in a way that there is a delay between the time that the act of suicide was done and the time death has occurred, then the person may be buried together with anyone else, such as in the case when a person commits suicide by drowning, God forbid. In such a case, the person can be buried together with everyone else. What is the explanation? That since the person has been conscious for at least a few moments before dying, we assume and give the person the benefit of the doubt that certainly they have done tshuva, they have regretted the act which they have done, and thereby, by regretting the act, have corrected their transgression. They are already underwater, and it is impossible for their life to be saved at that point. But nevertheless, since through this one thought they have regretted what they have done, this has changed the person from the category of being in such a situation where they cannot even be buried together with anyone else, to having a full portion in the world to come and so on, just as any other Jew has. We therefore see the tremendous power of even one thought of changing the person's entire afterlife, which the value of the afterlife, as it says in Pirkei Avos, is inestimable in comparison with the life in this physical world. And through one thought in this world can completely change what happens to them in the world to come. And even in a person whose brainwaves are not registering, as we mentioned previously in our discussion of quote-unquote brain death, not all brainwaves are measured, first of all. And second of all, there is no medical measurement to determine when thought is occurring. That even without these waves, it is more than possible that thought is still occurring. And there is no medical way of determining this. And therefore, certainly it's possible the person is still thinking and capable of changing the entire character of their existence in the world to come. Secondly, even should there be a way that the medical community could determine that thought is no longer existence, we have an explanation in Chassidic philosophy of the tremendous value of the unity of the soul and the body. That the soul, being a purely spiritual existence, entity, coming together with a coarse physical body, is such a fusion of opposites that is termed the power of mafli lases, that it's one of the miracles God does to bind the soul with the body. And the mere existence of the soul together in a physical body causes a tremendous purification of physical existence. That even through doing mitzvahs and performing God's will here in the world, the physical body is strengthened, is purified and elevated to a tremendous extent. But even without that, God forbid, the mere fact that the two are existing together in fact is also fulfilling, perhaps in a less intense way, but also to a certain extent the purification of the physical world, which, as explained in Tanya and throughout Chassidic writings, is the purpose of the creation of a physical world in order that it should be purified and elevated, and that a dwelling place in the physical should be made for godliness. And this is accomplished by human life. When the life is shortened, God forbid, and the connection between the soul and body is severed, the body no longer is being purified. And after the soul has left the body is left lifeless, obviously, and from this we see the source of the tremendous power of tumas meis, that then the impurity comes, and is such a severe one can be conveyed to others. But until then, the value of life is inestimable in terms of quality of life, and what can be seen by the naked eye. These are all explanations of the value of life, but nevertheless, they are not the foundation of the law that one is forbidden from shortening a life. They are simply explanations which can be given in order to make it comprehensible in a rational sense as well. And they are not. If we should find some case when these explanations do not apply, nevertheless, we are left with the law that the value of life cannot be tampered with. And as the Mishnah Nova says, that we live by force against our will and we die by force against our will, that our lives are entrusted to God Almighty to determine when it begins and when it ends. Thank you for tuning into the daily portion of Sefer Mitzvahs. For more information or to sponsor one of the installments, contact Sichas in English at area code 718-778-5436. That's 718-778-5436. And please join us again tomorrow.